This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Stephanie Regal of the Baton Rouge Business Report. She will talk about the dust-up between Mayor-President Kip Holden and his former top aide, Walter Mansour. Those two are on different planets at the moment. Also, what's going on with Highland Coffees? Now 2 months and 2 days away from closure unless something changes. And we'll hear from Chris Broadwater, Republican, and John Bell Edwards, Democrat, both representatives from Tangipahoa Parish, and they're involved in the changes involving the Office of Group Benefits. Chris Broadwater says he's received more calls about this issue than any other in his tenure in the Louisiana House. We'll discuss the latest developments with them. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. It's 877-217-5757. And Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. You may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show if you wish. And Frank Barnett is producing. And our leadoff guest is Stephanie Regal, the editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Much going on in your world and ours. And first of all, what's the latest involving Mayor President Kip Holden and his one-time trusty sidekick, Walter Mansour?
Is that an interesting story or what? I think a lot of people probably didn't see this one coming. I think behind the scenes, it's been building for a while. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, Walter Mansour was saying the RDA is going to run out of money and we need to find a permanent source of funding. It's something he's been talking about for a couple of years, really. I mean, they knew this day would come. And all of a sudden, it's escalated into this blood war between Mansour and the mayor, you know, who he served as chief of staff during his first term. And many people credit him with really running City Hall and for many of the great things that happened during that first administration. I think, you know, I polled the council last week, and they were pretty well divided. But at that point, it didn't look like there were 8 votes to give the RDA the $3 million that it wants out of the general fund. You know, they're going to go to the council during the budget hearings in December. Certainly things may change, and not all of the council members wanted to disclose to me what their position is on the issue, which I certainly understand. But I did talk to the mayor about it Monday at the Mary Landrieu Bill Clinton event. And, you know, he still has a lot of very pointed, heated rhetoric, you know, about Mansour, but he seemed a little more conciliatory towards the agency as a whole, and this was just my take on it, so I'm not saying this is, you know, what's absolutely going to happen, but he was talking about, well, you know, I'm not opposed to the agency or to keeping some form of the agency going, but he said, we need to overhaul it, we need to look at ways to have it partner with other community city agencies that are also doing redevelopment, and you know, I think talking to some of the council members, what may end up happening is an RDA without a Walter Mansour, an RDA that would look different than the RDA does today, and that would partner more with other agencies.
Well, today's Advocate, Lanny Keller, has a column about the feud between the mayor and Mansour. And much of the dispute involves Walter Mansour's salary, $265,000 a year plus perks and lots of perks. He makes about 3 times as much a year as the mayor does. Now this would seem to be an inequity. How has this gone on for several years without people questioning
it? That's sort of been my question, because I think that is a big flashpoint, and I think more information is going to come out about the perks and about the benefits, you know, when we see how it is, how that money's been, you know, totally put to use. But I asked John Nolan, the chairman of the RDA and the gentleman who was influential in helping to get it started several years ago, you know, this salary is nothing new.
No.
This salary, and I remember there were some questions raised 6 years ago or so when the agency was created, but then nobody said boo about it until recently. I asked some of the council members, you know, and the mayor about it, and the only answer they could give was that now that Walter's asking for public money, and now that he's had so many years to do something, with what he's had at the agency, and he hadn't done it. That's what makes the salary a problem now at this mm-hmm. point. But I don't know that I really buy that.
I would think that Walter Mansour could relieve a lot of the criticism if he agreed to work pro bono. And he has been paid so handsomely over the last several years, maybe this would be an appropriate thing for him to suggest.
Well, and he has told the RDA board and the leadership of that board that he would be willing to step down. I don't know that he has offered to do volunteer work for them, you know, but I really think it will come to that probably. Well, because I just don't see, with as much criticism, as much heat surrounding it now, I don't know how this blows over without some sort of fundamental change. I also don't believe the city is going to let this agency die, because what it's doing is the reason that it was created is still a valid reason, you know. And there is a tremendous need to redevelop blighted properties in inner city Baton Rouge. It's just what is the best way to do that? Who is the best person to lead an agency that can accomplish that, and how should it be done?
Is Walter Mansour running for mayor?
I think he's still on the fence. I heard a
huge pay cut.
Yeah, I heard as recently as yesterday that he was definitely in, but he certainly didn't tell me that. And when I've spoken to him about it, he said he's still very much on the fence. I know there's a lot of support for him, but I think he would, because he has been, like anybody who's out there who's a strong leader, who's an effective leader, but a very strong personality, he's been very controversial.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lanny closes his column by saying the prospects for RDA survival, much less success, are diminished by a civil war in Kipdom. Is that where we're living, in Kipdom?
I don't know. You know, it's a great column. I wasn't sure about that last line, but it was a great column. And let's just give a plug to Lanny, because I'm so happy for him that he has debut column today. He's a very talented writer.
He writes a lot of the editorials.
Oh, I know.
Don't have the names on them.
Great to see that he finally gets credit for it.
Lanny and Danny. But now Lanny is front and center writing columns, and he writes good ones. And this is an issue that I think bars or warrants attention, and Lanny is giving it just that. So we shall see where it goes. What do you think will happen between Mansour and Holden?
It doesn't really matter what I think. I mean, I would bet, though, that they're going to let the rhetoric die down, that the mayor will probably tone it down a bit. I mean, it may heat up again when the budget hearings come to pass, but I would wager that there's going to be some sort of resolution before it goes to the council. I'm sure that they're trying to work things out behind the scenes. I don't think the city's going to let the RDA die. Mm-hmm. I do think there will be some sort of revamping of the RDA. I think there will be some compromises negotiated over this.
Now, Jeremy writes that much has been made of Charlie Roberts' former salary with the Alumni Association. Walter Mansour earns more than Charlie Roberts. Why isn't he given the same attention that Dr. Roberts was given?
Well, I mean, they were in very different positions, but
both very successful, though, depending on your point of view. But when you compare the Alumni Association with where it was 30 years ago and where it is now, I don't think there's any question that Charlie Roberts brought it to a new level. Now, some say it should be at an even higher level, but you did a nice profile on funding at LSU.
And the idea behind that story was really to look at some of the inefficiencies and the fact that they have not worked together. You know, that yes, he built the Alumni Association into this very powerful, big entity at LSU, but is it really delivering? Is it working with the foundation in the way, now it may be, but has it been over the past 10 years, you know, or so, been working with the foundation as well as it could have been to really maximize the foundation's fundraising potential? And when you look at the size of our overall endowment and our rate of alumni giving, it's not impressive at all. And we're among the lowest in the SEC, and our endowment is among the lowest in the SEC. So if he was doing such a great job, and if the Alumni Association was so great, then why are our numbers so pitiful? Well, Louisiana has at least as much money as Mississippi, and they're way better than us.
Okay. If you say that that's Charlie Roberts' responsibility for the endowment, I'm not sure it would be, but it is an all-inclusive thing as far as raising funds for LSU, and King Alexander has some ideas, and I would suspect that the king will be given the keys to the kingdom to determine whether things can be enhanced.
Well, he's going to be bringing in a vice president, I think is going to be the title, for institutional advancement, who is going to wear dual hats and who is going to report to him, but also oversee all three of those independent foundations at LSU, TAF, Alumni Association, and the big LSU Foundation. And he's going to serve as CEO of the LSU Foundation. And so the administration of the university is going to have a much bigger hand, or at least a lot more oversight of fundraising activities. And so you don't really have these fiefdoms out there building their own empires, or, you know.
But I imagine that'll be another high-paying job that the taxpayers will have to absorb to, and hopefully for LSU's sake, raise money for the old war school. Now, speaking of LSU, Bob Mann tweeted a few days ago, and I'll paraphrase him, that he wishes half the attention given to the Highland Coffee's controversy was given to budget cuts at Louisiana State University. Highland Coffee's has certainly caught the imagination of the populace of Baton Rouge.
Well, and that was really the point when I opened my column, talking about how there are so many more pressing issues, and people took aim, you know, at me for that immediately and said, no, you missed the point. I mean, the point is there are all sorts of much bigger injustices and things that people should be riled up about, which is not to minimize the story of Highland Coffees, this beloved coffee shop that's been on West Chime Street there for 25 years and is now apparently going to be forced to close at the end of the year because the landlord was not able to negotiate a new lease with the owner of the business. People are outraged. It's a community institution. People love it. It is a wonderful coffee shop, and I understand that. But the purpose of my column in writing about it was just to sort of point out some of the realities of market conditions in commercial real estate, and particularly in that high-demand area, and some of the challenges that businesses there face. And
well, that area, and I know it well, that's my area. Chime Street is really not a great spot for a business. There's no parking. And I know Clark pays more per square foot than many other businesses on Chime Street. And when you look over the years, nobody else has lasted 25 years other than the library down the street. It's not the kind of a cash register that we see with the Chimes,
right?
Which has ample parking. So I'm not sure a restaurant will succeed there. There may be somebody willing to take a chance and pay a higher rent than Clark does, Clark Cadzo, the owner of Highland Coffees, but it's certainly not a prescription for success.
No, it's not. And I mean, if you talk to any of the business owners around there, they will tell you that. I think that's one reason why you've seen so many of the national chains come in. And for instance, when they redeveloped that shopping center over on State Street just a block away, all of the tenants in there now are national chains, the Buffalo Wild Wings and the, you know, sushi bar and the pita pit and whatever else they have over there, because those sort of franchise operations have the muscle behind them. You know, I would hope that what would come of this would be some sort of a way to keep the business there. The property owner, Hank Siraj, took so much heat, and perhaps even the restaurant that was interested in moving in there backed out, or at least sort of got cold feet. And so Hank did reach out to Clark, and they're talking. I don't know how much, but I know they are still negotiating. They're working towards something that may keep the coffee shop open. But, I mean, the reality is I think a coffee shop may need another business model to stay viable in that kind of a location.
297-5633. We'll talk about Highland Coffees a bit more with Stephanie Regal, who wrote a column about it in this edition, the current one of the Baton Rouge Business Report. Highland Coffees will celebrate its 25th anniversary somewhat forlornly next month if an agreement is not reached. At the way it stands now, the shop will close on Christmas Eve, 2 months and 2 days away, but there are discussions ongoing, and of course, Hank Siraj is part of the family that owns Community Coffee, and some believe that this is a way to get rid of a competitor. We shall talk with Stephanie Regal about this when we return. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, and we have some more time with Stephanie Regal coming in a bit. Representatives Chris Broadwater and John Bell Edwards. Hugh at LSU. Good morning, Hugh. You're on with Stephanie Regal. Hi, Hugh.
Hi, how are you doing? Listen, Stephanie, I did mention just before the break something about community coffee. And I was wondering, because Siraj, everybody knows, is a name and has been connected with community coffee. One nice thing about the Highland Coffee was that there was such a great variety of coffees brought in there. And one of the things I loved was the variety of coffees that would be stacked around there in Clark's place.
All right, well, do you have a question, Hugh?
My question is, do you think that the interest in community coffee with Hank Siraj might be part of the, you know, the machinations going on in this?
No. I mean, I would bet every meager penny I have and my three children, I promise you, that's not behind this. I mean, of course, Siraj's family owns Community Coffee. His brother runs it now. He is not affiliated with the business, which is not to say he doesn't have some sort of interest in it. But, you know, I mean, Highland Coffee isn't any sort of competitive threat to Community. And the same issues that would make that corner challenging for Highland would make it challenging for Community. You know, I'm pretty sure the tenant that he had lined up was a restaurant from New Orleans, and a locally owned, homegrown New Orleans sort of institution. So, you know, would it have been a good fit there? Might it still one day be a good fit there? I don't know. But he did not have plans to put a coffee shop there or to snuff Highland Coffees out of business to help Communities and CCs.
All right. Renee on I-10. Renee, thank you, Hugh. Renee, you're on with Stephanie. Hi.
Thank you, Jim. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
I must agree with you, Stephanie. I think, at least I think I'm agreeing with you. I think this thing over the Highland Coffee, and I read your article in the business report, is a lot of, you know, this is between two private businesses, and they should decide who is and who isn't in that space. I understand Highland is a great store, but my question goes to the LSU Alumni Association. Out of the funds that are raised by the Alumni Association specifically, how much went to administration versus how much went to salaries and how much actually was given back to LSU? Do you have any?
That's a great question, and I do have that data, but I don't have it, you know, right in front of me, and so I wouldn't want to misspeak. Their primary role was not to raise money per se for the university. Their mission is to be a support organization for the foundation, which is the primary fundraising organ of the university. But the issue was over the years, the lack of cooperation, sort of the territorial nature in which they would conduct their business and their outreach efforts. And you know, the idea was really for the Alumni Association to keep touch with all the alumni and then to make it easy for the foundation to track them down and solicit from them. And for a long time, that just wasn't being done as well as it could have been. And a lot of their money and effort was going to building big buildings and to salaries. Salaries for just a couple of key people. The overhead of the administration of that association was not evenly dispersed among a lot of well-paid employees, but there were a handful of well-paid employees.
That's true in the public sector, the private sector. But how can the president of LSU earn $600,000 a year and the governor of Louisiana get $135,000 a year?
Wow, that's a very good question for another day.
I would think that a law, if some lawmaker, perhaps Representative Broadwater or Representative Edwards, might file it, saying that no public official in Louisiana can earn more than the governor.
Yeah, the problem you run into, though, is, again, it's just like this Highland Coffee thing. It's market forces are at work, and I think the university could plausibly make the argument that how can you attract a top-flight leader to run our flagship university, mm-hmm. somebody that would be equally at home at Tulane or John Hopkins or, you know, some other Stanford, some other great school, if they're only going to make $150,000 a year. Okay, so that's a lot to you and I, maybe, but not in the corporate world, not in higher education executive circles. It's just not.
But we have the food and the people and the weather.
Oh, yeah, all that great stuff.
The beautiful campus.
Festivals all day.
Yeah, so that counts.
Well, maybe we could cap it at something.
It's like I'll pay more at Highland Coffees for a cup of coffee than I will at McDonald's because I enjoy the scenery and visiting with the patrons. And selfishly, I don't want that to go away. Do you think something will be resolved in this dispute that is ongoing, if it is a dispute?
I know that negotiations are ongoing. And from what I've been able to gather, I think things are moving in a positive direction, but I couldn't say for sure.
So 2 months and 2 days away, and there is going to be continuing reaction. Over 6,000 people, I think, have signed a petition. And the people at Community Coffees, they have a marketing department that they spend probably millions of dollars a year on. That they do it to get good publicity. This has not been particularly good publicity for Community Coffee.
No, and Siraj really has taken a beating, whether, you know, some people think it's justified. Again, the purpose of my column was just to lay out some of the realities of market conditions there and to point out that a lot of people don't really know what he offered Clark and what the terms of their deal were. He's not the horrible person that he was portrayed to be. Somebody raised an interesting point in one of the comments on my website and said, you know, if you want to talk about Siraj's return on his investment, how much is enough? What should he be getting? 50%, 60%, 70%? And I mean, that's an interesting philosophical question. But I mean, how much should any business owner expect to make on his investment? I mean, at what point do you say, okay, I'm just going to be a nice guy and let this tenant stay in here for half market rate or a quarter market rate because out of the goodness of my heart or because I'm a good Christian? It sounds great. Maybe that's what we would all do if we were in his position. Who knows? But that's not the way the market works. That's not the way capitalism
works.
But
I think Clark is good for that block in the neighborhood because he has a stable business and good clients. And it's not a success story, believe me, on Chime Street. And another problem is that, like the Buffalo Wild Wings, that parking lot, people will park over there, walk over to Highland Coffees, have a cup of coffee, and unfortunately they come back and Riverside Towing has towed their vehicle.
Right.
Because there's no parking sometimes, unless you park on the street, and the street sometimes is full. So I would be reluctant to go into business without any parking. But
I agree. And I mean, you know, maybe, Siraj owned that building for 3 years. I have to think he had given it some thought, but maybe now, hopefully, he's given it a little more thought, just in terms of how valuable or what a good tenant Highland Coffees is and why they should stay. But, you know, the onus is also on the customers there. You know, if you're going to go hang out there all day, maybe you have to buy more than one cup of coffee. Maybe you have to be willing to support him if he raises his prices a little bit.
Well, it seems like...
I mean, Reginelli's closes down for 3 months of the year.
They did this year.
I mean, that was one of their solutions to being able to stay in business on that difficult street.
The gelato place down the street is not doing well. The Chinese place is about to close. It is just a tough, tough area for a business. And really, I think a restaurant wouldn't give pause about locating there. Now, here's a question. I think it's a legitimate one. If it's true, it says the law firm of Rolfe, this is from June Manuel, the law firm of Rolfe's brother Stephen McAllister does the least work for Hank Siraj. Is that correct?
I have absolutely no idea.
Okay. 2975633. Will in South Baton Rouge. Will, you're on with Stephanie.
Good morning. I want to suggest a location that is not too far away from Tigertown. It's the old Carver Library on Highland Road at the corner with Louise. It's an old South Baton Rouge.
Yeah,
it's ripe for development here in this vicinity because there's a lot of gentrification that's starting to go on, and if somebody would take over that building, it was a church for a while after the library closed up and they built a new one, but it's...
All right. Well, that would be a good location for a coffee shop, and it could be named Highland Coffees, I suppose, but it's a couple of miles from LSU.
Yeah, I think that would be the biggest challenge is that people wouldn't be able to walk there from campus or without taking a hike. I mean, the great thing about Highland's current location is it's just right there out of the gates.
Kendrick on government. Kendrick, good morning. You're on with Stephanie.
Hi, Jim. I just wanted to echo that I have no connection to the Siraj family in any way, but Hank is in the business of running a real estate company, and I'm sure that trumps any interest in the coffee company, and so I agree that the onus is on the customers to support this institution.
All right. There are community coffee locations all over campus now. And I would think that if Highland closes, those locations might do a bit better. But community is a big company. It's not going to rise or fall no matter what happens to Highland Coffees.
And I would wager that that Highland customers out of protest would make a point to never patronize a community coffee in Baton Rouge, on the LSU campus, or anywhere.
That's why I think cooler heads will prevail.
I do.
And hopefully Clark will be able to be around for a 50th anniversary celebration that we'll be talking about, Stephanie and I will, on this show in, what will that be, 2039?
Something like that.
Okay. But we'll see what happens. If it closes on Christmas Eve, I can see the headlines now, the Grinch stole Christmas, right?
And yeah.
By the way, Jeremy White of RegStick gave Hank Siraj his hero highlight. He says, we applaud Siraj for having the courage not to let something as trivial as the sentimentality of countless Baton Rougeans or even his own reputation get in the way of making a few extra bucks by leasing the Highland Coffees building to an eatery that's sure to be gone by 2017. That's certainly a different point of view. But a business person who has an offer for somebody to come in and pay a higher rent, usually that's an easy call, but there are some mitigating factors here that may end up resolving this, and hopefully all will be happy because there will be riots in the streets, perhaps.
There will be riots in the street. Just judging from the tenor of comments that we had on our website, the vitriol, the hatred, the flashpoint, the emotion, it is mind-boggling. So,
and more probably on this than any story you've written about.
It's been a while.
Have you written about the Office of Group Benefits?
No.
Well, that's another hot button, and as we switch gears here, we thank you, Stephanie, and now we're going to get two people on opposite sides of the political aisle to discuss what's going on with OGB. But thank you, Stephanie, and appreciate you coming in and taking the heat that comes with writing a provocative column. Chris Broadwater and John Bell Edwards, they're neighboring lawmakers in Tangipahoa Parish. One is a Republican, Chris, and one is a Democrat, John Bell Edwards, who's running for governor, and both are immersed in this dispute over the Office of Group Benefits and the changes that have ensued over the last few months. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you.
Well, Chris, I preface this by saying, if I heard you right, you said that you've gotten more calls on this issue than any other.
I think so, Jim. It's been a hot issue in my district. Of course, I have many state employees that are employed at Southeastern Louisiana University, at our North Shore Community and Technical College, Department of Transportation. We have lots of state employees there, but of course, teachers and many others that are insured through the OGB program, this has been important to them, and particularly retirees have called my office a great deal. So it has been an issue of great interest in my district.
John Bell Edwards, what's going on as far as where we stand right now?
Well, as we stand right now, the
process, thankfully, has been slowed somewhat because the administration decided to follow the law and the Administrative Procedures Act as far as rulemaking is concerned. And so they have started the process of public notice, receiving public input, and then legislative oversight. So with respect to the plan changes, they were delayed for the most part from January the 1st until March the 1st to allow time to go through that process, which I think the administration did the right thing in light of the Attorney General's opinion that I asked for that said doing these changes without going through that process would be illegal. And so we now have an opportunity, both the public and the legislature, to weigh in and hopefully convince the administration to move away from these draconian out-of-pocket cost increases on our officer group benefits members, especially those retirees. We have 25,000 retirees who are not eligible for Medicare, and this is going to hurt them in a big way. And it's also going to hurt a lot of OGB members who are active but bring home as little as $700 a month. And, of course, it's not good for any of our members. So hopefully we can make some changes going forward, and maybe this $178 million surplus, should it be real, give us the opportunity to do that.
Representative Broadwater, you are a Republican. John Bel Edwards, a Democrat. Often you're on different sides as far as the way you vote. But on this one, is there some common ground?
Well, I think there is. From the standpoint, you know, I think there are multiple issues here. One area that I suspect there is some common ground between Representative Edwards and me is on the issue of the administration of the program. All of us want to make sure that any program that is run by the state, and we're dealing with state general fund dollars, that it's done in a prudent fiscal manner. And that's one of the significant questions that has come up that has resonated with members of all parties. And making sure we do that right. And I think that we'll see legislation in the upcoming session trying to ensure that we don't repeat this issue in years down the road, that we have more structure in place. So on that point, I suspect that we are in lockstep with each other on that issue. You know, but there are larger issues here as well. I mean, there's a policy issue as what is the appropriate amount of insurance and what benefit is appropriate for the employees of the state and where the state has a significant financial contribution in it. And then there's an additional issue, as I see it, from the role of the state as an employer. And as you begin making changes to any benefit package for your employees, our employees are our greatest resource, ensuring that that's done in a way that is responsible. And many of the employees that have talked to me and retirees have said, well, we will pay more. Just communicate with us and let's work on a solution that puts us in a stable financial position in terms of OGB and something that we can afford. I think that that's something that we could do a better job on in communicating with those benefit plan members to make sure that as we make any transition, that it's done in a responsible way and is properly communicated to folks that are part of a larger team. We've all have been asking our state employees to deal with some significant changes over the last 4 to 6 years. It's going to be important that we have them on board and as team members, and the way to best do that is to communicate effectively with them, particularly when you're dealing with a benefit that hits their pocket.
297-5633. We will go to the phones with Representative John Bel Edwards, Democrat from Meade, and Representative Chris Broadwater, a Republican who calls Hammond home. And they're in accord, for the most part, on what's going on with the Office of Group Benefits. We'll find out more when we return. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. John Bel Edwards and Chris Broadwater on the Office of Group Benefits. Now, some are saying that this has been a self-inflicted wound by the Jindal administration. Representative Edwards, what do you think?
Well, I'm one of those who's been saying it, so I agree with that. And let me tell you, that speaks to why what Chris Broadwater just said is so correct. We've got to change the structure. We've got a system now where the Commissioner of Administration unilaterally decided to reduce premiums over 2 years by 9%, even though health care costs were going up 6% a year. And this created a situation where our fund balance was depleted from over $500 million to less than $200 million and bleeding about $16 million a month. And so they declared this emergency, and they want the OGB members now to shoulder the full cost at about $189 million. Well, that's just wrong, because the commissioner was not relying upon any actuarial recommendations, even though OGB has a contract with an actuarialist, Buck Consultants. Buck Consultants did not recommend a premium decrease in 13 or 14, and so these problems were created in order to save the 75% state and employer match on these premiums to spend elsewhere in the budget. And so this problem was created. It was budgetarily driven, not actuarially driven. And now the answer coming from the administration is, well, the employees and the members of OGB, they can shoulder the full cost. Well, I think that's wrong. And hopefully we can change the structure, make sure that we have somebody other than the CEO of OGB and the Commissioner of Administration deciding what the premiums should be going forward. And there's several options there, and I'll be exploring those with Chris and other legislators with legislation that I can guarantee you will be introduced in April.
Jim on airline. Jim, good morning. You're on with Representatives Edwards and Broadwater.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning. I'd like to tell the two legislatures how I really feel about this thing. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, medical expenses and especially drugs were rising at such a rate that small businesses were dropping policies, and all of private industry was raising deductibles to unaffordable rates. The Affordable Care Act did not correct that by not putting in a single-payer system. And I'm here to tell you that the right amount of insurance is something that will not allow ruin to happen to a family. So I'm suggesting that we have to control medical costs, or we're not going to win this.
All right. Representative Broadwater, do those two to go together, those issues?
Well, I think that the caller raises a good point. You see medical inflation rising at just a staggering rate, and it is a much more complicated problem than just trying to get medical rates under control. I also know that we have hospitals that are struggling to stay afloat because of a lot of the regulations that are in place on them and the reimbursement rates that we have in the Medicaid system. We've got constitutional amendments on the ballot this fall because of that very issue. But the caller is right. Medical costs are staggering. It's a cost to the state. It's a cost to our state employees and to the citizens across the state, regardless of whether they are employed by the state or not. It is a much bigger problem that cannot be solved with a very simple solution. But it is a larger equation that really needs to be debated, needs to be discussed. I think Congress needs to take the issue back up. I agree with the call. I don't believe the Affordable Care Act solved the problem. But the issue of affordable health care and quality health care in America is absolutely a debate we ought to be engaged in. I just tend to think that the Affordable Care Act was not the right solution for that.
Representative Edwards?
Well, I don't believe it's proper to blame the Affordable Care Act for this problem because are medical costs increasing at a rate that presents a problem? Absolutely. But as the caller mentioned, that was happening before the Affordable Care Act, and it continues. I would point out that in states like Arkansas that fully embraced the Affordable Care Act, implemented the exchanges, and did the Medicaid expansion, health care premiums are going to decrease next year by 2%. They're going to increase in Louisiana by a much larger amount because we have too many people going to the hospitals and to the doctor who are uninsured. And so those who have insurance are going to pay more to compensate that, even though we're already paying the federal taxes to at least do the Medicaid expansion. So I don't think the two are absolutely related. The absolutely highest cost associated with the Affordable Care Act with respect to officer group benefits is $2 million a month, and it's a $16 million a month problem. So it's not something that's driving this issue.
Tom Aswell of Louisiana Voice writes that the recently discovered $178 million surplus provides the means to reduce the cost increases on OGB members. Your thoughts, Representative Broadwater?
Well, first we need to determine whether or not there is a surplus. And I think that the Appropriations Committee is going through the prudent measures to have the legislative auditor look into the issue as well. If, in fact, there is a surplus there, then I would tend to agree that may be something that could at least provide a short-term solution to provide more time for debate on the issue as to what the appropriate policy is for the state to be providing the appropriate benefit to its employees. If, in fact, that surplus is not there, as suggested, then we go back just to the original problem we have with a significant deficit, projected deficit facing us next year. But it remains to be seen whether or not that surplus exists.
Representative Edwards?
Yeah, and that's got to sound frustrating to our listeners, because it's frustrating to me that here we are, we don't know whether we have $178 million surplus or not, because the folks at the legislative fiscal office and the legislative auditor and the folks in the administration can't agree on whether there's $178 million sitting in our checking accounts. And certainly if they can't agree, I don't know, but I can tell you this, if the money is there, there is no better way to use it than to restore that fund balance and lessen the impact on the out-of-pocket costs on our OGB members, because I just think it's the right thing to do.
Based on the way the surplus was reached, do you think that was a valid way to handle the budget?
Well, the way the surplus was reached, now,
if there is a surplus,
as I understand it, the money that they're talking about may have been, if it exists, it may have been there for as many as 15 or 16 years. So we don't have a surplus on an annual basis if we look back to just last year. And in fact, last year, I don't think there's any doubt the administration spent $141 million more than it took in. The question is whether there was a 300-something million-dollar cushion in our checking account that had been unaccounted for previously. So I don't even know whether the laws that we have allow something like that to be called a surplus. And if it is a surplus, the law does require us to do certain things with it, like pay towards the unfunded accrued liability, and other things. And so, you know, even all of that $178 million wouldn't be available under the best of circumstances, but whatever is available could be used to defease debt next year and create the same amount of cash money that could be put into the Office of Group Benefits fund balance.
All right. Representative Broadwater?
No, I agree with Representative Edwards. I mean, if in fact that money does exist and it's available for expenditure, what we need to make sure of is that we understand that it is simply essentially cash sitting in a savings account or checking account somewhere. It's not going to be a recurring source of revenue. And so there are certain things we're required to do with those types of funds. Let's make sure that we do things right. We follow what the law says. If, in fact, there is any remaining amount left over, certainly I think OGB is a high priority based on what my constituents are telling me. There are also additional priorities in my district, and that's funding higher education, ensuring that we try to stabilize that funding source. We have many, many issues that need to be addressed, but that absolutely is an issue that ought to be debated, and OGB ought to be part of that debate.
Frank in Slidell. Hi, Frank. You're on with Representative Chris Broadwater and State House Member John Bell Edwards.
This is Frank Gilbert. I'm actually in Slidell right now, but I'm the executive director of the Retired State Employees Association of Louisiana. And I'm listening to your show, and I'm glad to hear what sounds like bipartisan support from Mr. Broadwater and Mr. Edwards to try to help us get fixed for this Office of Group Benefits problem, which, as has been stated, was something that's been created by the administration, and we really need the help of the legislature at this point to get this thing back on the right track. We're not looking for a free ride. We're not expecting to get free insurance or, you know, anything that isn't common in the workplace for most folks, whether they be state employees or other residents of Louisiana. But our task in front of us seems to be is to make this plan sustainable, affordable for our members, especially the lower paid employees and retirees who can least afford the impact of these, what we consider to be egregious changes.
All right. Thank you, Frank. Appreciate you calling. We're still several months away from a legislative session. What can be done between now and then, if anything?
Well, this is Representative Broadwater. First, I would note that a lot of the media always portrays the differences between the parties, but let me comment first about Representative John Bell Edwards, who I consider to be a dear friend and a very good legislator. There are many things that we agree on as well, and this happens to be one of many that we do agree on and work together on. what Mr. Joubert raises, I think there are two issues. There's a short-term issue immediately facing members of OGB, and there is a longer-term issue that needs to be addressed to ensure that we don't continue to repeat past mistakes. In terms of the short-term issue, that's a difficult one to tackle. As Representative Edwards mentioned, we have a little more time now with the notice and comment period going on. We don't go into session until into April, and so you're right. There's not a lot legislatively unless some legislative action is taken with regard to the rulemaking process, and whether that will or will not be done certainly remains to be seen. But on the longer-term issue, I think, is the more important thing to ensure that we provide a system that is stable going forward. One of the things that I'll be proposing is that we handle this program much like we handle other programs that are regulated by the state that deal with insurance. Let's have an annual actuarial analysis of the program with a recommendation as to what premiums ought to be, and then let's have some approval process for that annual premium, whether that is a review by the Commissioner of Insurance, whether we give that authority to the OGB board to approve that premium rate, or whether it is going before joint budget to get that premium rate. Not in a way to make political points with either party, but to ensure that we have a stable funding source, that we're charging the right amount of premium, not so low that we have insufficient funds to pay the bills, but not so high that we are charging a rate that is more than necessary to pay bills and putting an undue burden on the plan members. To me, that is a more important question. Mm-hmm. We can talk about the politics of how we got here, but that doesn't necessarily solve the problem long-term for the folks of the state. And so I look forward to hopefully receiving bipartisan support on that proposal this year to make sure we have some stability for the long-term.
Representative Edwards?
Well, I agree with Chris and everything that he just said, and he and I do work together on a number of issues. This is not the only one. But in the short term, we also have another issue, Jim, and that is on September 30th, OGB announced an emergency rule, adopted an emergency rule with respect to pharmaceutical benefit changes. The problem is those changes were made on August the 1st, and they require higher out-of-pocket costs on OGB members for pharmaceutical benefits than the law allowed. So for every claim incurred for pharmaceutical benefits between August 1st and September the 30th, our members paid more than the law allowed. And I'm hopeful that the administration will reprocess all those claims and voluntarily refund the amount that was illegally taken from these members without making those individual members file appeals or file some sort of a lawsuit. So that's another issue that we have. And clearly, we just need an administration that will follow the law faithfully, and not only with respect to the emergency rule, but just going forward in all aspects of this officer group benefits debacle, as well as the rest of the way that we run our state government.
All right. Please be brief. John in Lafayette, you're on with Chris Broadwater and John Bell Edwards.
Gentlemen, just real quickly on the hospital's dedication in Constitutional Amendment 1 and the retirement homes Constitutional Amendment 2, I'd like your views on those two. And if they pass, how will higher education be funded?
All right, Amendments 1 and 2, any thoughts from?
Well, there's not a direct impact on the ability to fund higher education as it relates to number 1 and number 2. If they get adopted by the members, by the voters in the state, then with respect to a certain portion of Medicaid funding for hospitals and nursing homes primarily, but also others, I think pharmacies and so forth, there will be a floor of funding in the Medicaid program, at least in part. And to the extent that there's a constitutional protection for that funding, then in an event of a downturn, when we have a deficit that we have to deal with and we have to cut spending, then we wouldn't be allowed to cut spending in those areas, perhaps, which may direct more of the spending reductions in other areas of state government, which could include higher education. So I guess it's potentially possible that there would be a bleed over there. There are some people, however, who've looked at Constitutional Amendments 1 and 2, and they believe that it would actually draw down more Medicaid money from the federal government, which would give us more money to spend on things like higher education.
So it's not entirely clear what the right. impact would be.
All right, Representative Broadwater, your thoughts on Amendments 1 and 2.
Well, I'm predisposed with just about any constitutional amendment to lean towards no, just from the standpoint that I think we've amended our Constitution too much to begin with. Right. Secondly, I have a predisposition towards a no, at least with Amendment Number 1, only from the standpoint that my preference is that we tie our hands less so that our legislature is able to budget based upon its priorities rather than an artificial restriction in terms of what we can and cannot spend money on by protecting certain funds. I don't disagree with Representative Edwards with regard to some analysis that suggested, particularly with regard to Amendment Number 2, that it may provide an avenue to draw down additional federal Medicaid funds that may help us overall. My only issue there is that I believe that there is a mechanism to do that through statutory authority that we already have. And through...
All right, we've got a roll. But, gentlemen, you're a good tandem. Hopefully we'll have occasion to talk again soon. John Bell Edwards and Chris Broadwater, we're back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.